This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Really appreciate y'all taking time from your day to join us for another edition of Midrats. Whether you're on the podcast or you're with that esteemed cohort that's joining us live. And if you are with us live, as always, I'd like to give you an invitation. You can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where you will find the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or if there are some questions you would like for us to address to our guest in the course of the next hour, that's a great place to put it. We'll be sitting there and watching it as we go forward. And we see Stephen has already joined us there, so you can keep Steve some company. And if you got to take off during the course of the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, if you haven't already done so, go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can subscribe to Midrats there. But now we're going to go ahead and roll into today's show. And time is a funny thing. It travels rather quickly, and today we live in an era where in the blink of an eye, at least for those of a certain age, we've gone from flip phones to smartphones that have an incredible computer capability. They're really not phones anymore. They're supercomputers from a few decades ago, plus that you keep in your back pocket that you can make phone calls on if you really want to. And it's amazing what has happened with technology and in the civilian sector, how people have seen nascent technologies and have built on it and progressed it and have created billion-dollar businesses with it. And there also is technology growth. You know, phones are no big deal. Phones have been around for well over a century, but we also have modern phones. And unmanned air systems or drones, whatever you will call, they have also been with us for a very, very long time. But there's been a fusion of both communication, computing, technology, and also aerospace engineering that has enabled new capabilities that, for those who have been watching it for a while, hasn't quite been advancing with leaps and bounds like we have seen in other areas in the civilian sector. And today we're going to explore that specifically with the U.S. Navy, though we may touch on some of the success or sister services have had our struggles. But today we're going to focus on the U.S. Navy and how it has been engaging or avoiding, depending upon your point of view, with unmanned air systems, drones, whatever you want to call it. And today we have three guests on board that are going to dive into the topic with us. We have Colonel Noah Spataro. We also have two Navy Lieutenant Commanders, Trevor Phillips Levine and Andrew Tinbook, U.S. Navy. And we're going to use as a starting point for our conversation the recent article in War on the Rocks titled Winged Luddites, Aviators Are the Biggest Threat to Carrier Aviation. And you can find a link to that article there in the show notes and on the show page. And just as a friendly reminder, these gentlemen are joining us today simply on their own. Their views do not necessarily represent that of the United States Navy or any other association that they may have. Trevor, Noah, and Andrew, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you very much, sir.
And just one of the joys of communications, we had two out of three of our guests on board. We kicked off the show, and our third had joined him, but we won't shame him. But I'll go ahead and start off with one of the folks I know we had good communications with. And Trevor, I wanted to open it, and then if you wanted to pass it on to your co-authors or that y'all just wanted to jump in at any point, obviously there's been a lot of ink spilled, a lot of words typed on unmanned systems for a long time. And we are at a point where everybody is focusing on the geography and the time-space challenges that we see trying to get across the Pacific are really anywhere outside of the range of systems that seek to deny what the Navy has always had as its power projection platforms. And y'all have reached the point with unmanned systems that you said, you know what, we need to go put some words to paper and we need to set out there, put a couple of markers there and start a conversation. So, Trevor, just to kind of kick off, talk about the process where you and your co-authors got together and the framework that y'all wanted to put together to hopefully bring this topic above the background noise.
Sure, absolutely, Sal. And first of all, thank you to you as well as Eagle One for and your audience for having us on the show there and talk about this very important subject. As far as like how it started, it started off with a independent air power research that I was just doing because I just had some curiosity. And as I started diving into the various aspects of the unmanned area, I started to have some questions in my mind, specifically the time frames that seemed rather elongated from when we were testing relatively nascent but promising technologies to where we are right now. And in that process, I started looking for subject matter experts in that area to kind of get a better idea, a better handle on the situation. And that led me to Colonel Sotero at JADC2, as well as Lieutenant Commander Andrew Tenbush, who is a former M5 strike, as well as he worked with the Queen Elizabeth Carrier Strike Group stand-up. And together, we got together, we started diving into school dive into acquisitions, the budgeting. Kramer went ahead, he went and studied the fire details as far as the tactics and so forth that kind of would highlight the need for the unmanned systems. And together we just kind of pulled our resources and came up with a product that you see.
Well, you guys have chosen to focus on carrier aviation, and in particular the unmanned aircraft that could fly from carriers. Was there a reason, I mean, is this the area where you see the most resistance to unmanned aircraft, or is this just because of your experience in the Navy generally?
So it was a combination of factors. As we looked into it, the Air Force had taken a very different standpoint with the system. But as we started, we didn't come in with the idea that there was resistance. It was more what our research kind of led us to. We got a hold of Dr. Hendrick's article, which was Retreat from Range, and it. That kind of the ending part of that study that he did kind of like made us ask the question like, okay, so we're experimenting with the X-47 drone, and then it was already established that we needed long range penetrating unmanned combat aerial systems or UCAS, and yet that program was canceled. And then as we looked at various other articles and text on a subject matter, we started to notice a developing trend. The other co-authors, specifically School, he has a firsthand experience as far as the Marine Corps side of particular resistance to unmanned aerial systems, and I'll let him kind of talk about that aspect of the resistance that we encountered.
Yeah, so the kind of historical findings there, a friend of mine, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo, wrote a dissertation at Georgetown on, you know, really trying to understand how the Marine Corps came from a frontline leader in unmanned systems adoption, remotely piloted vehicles, and how that changed in kind of the late 90s. And then in comparing deliberate decisions that the Air Force made and partnered with DARPA and the intelligence world to deliver, you know, what we know now today is the MQ-1 and then the MQ-9. And so as he did that research, and looking back at what we learned from the Israelis out of the 70s and early 80s and what became, the Massive and then the Pioneer, and the Navy was part of that. And I like the opening page that you guys had for this session and having the QH-50 dash, because the truth of the matter is that unmanned aviation adoption and applications go all the way back to really the early parts of aviation in the late 1900s, early 1900s, around 1920, and then developed further in 1940s during World War II with the TDR-1 Edna as a remotely controlled airplane to deliver munitions. And so what you find is you kind of do that history trail and you get to the QH-50 and really trying to face the Soviet fast attack sub threat and extend our destroyers. You come to this conclusion very quickly that most of the adoption of unmanned systems that happened within the Naval Aviation Enterprise were forced from other interested parties. And so, an example, you can actually see that in the current Naval Aviation Enterprise plan for 2035. It's highlighted in there as well, as you see that the adoption are programs that are replacing things like the EP-3, which is more intelligence-driven, the MQ-8 going from the Bravo to the Charlie, Fire Scout. That's really, legacy back to the QH-50, but that's really about OPNAV N-96 and the DESRON. So I found that same challenge in the Marine Corps in the adoption of aviation for aviation challenges as opposed to others' challenges. And that's what a lot of that research came to as well, is pushing off this idea of a guardian angel to support our infantry came back to that same struggle. And that is what changed from the 80s through the 90s and then early 2000s as we struggled through several platforms, through the Pioneer, the Shadow V2, RQ-21, and then just now, probably 15 years in the MQ-9, just now buying, essentially first generation MQ-9 Alphas. Hopefully that kind of helps in laying this out.
And I don't think we've heard from Andrew yet. So Andrew, if you wanted to, kind of jump in on this or anybody, but I definitely want to get back to the 25, but when you talk to a lot of people who keep their finger on the pulse of their systems and especially those who are really anticipating being able to get some platforms out to the fleet and do what the Navy has, the U.S. Navy really has a wonderful heritage going back from the start, which is, and it was boiled down a lot by Admiral Mayer's, build a little, test a little, learn a lot type of routine, but also just getting stuff out to the fleet, giving it to sailors, telling smart officers and their sailors, here this is what we think we can do with it, tell me what else you can do with it, and you have an iterative growth. And you go back to 2013, which for those looking at their calendar, we could have fought World War II twice in the length of time from 2013 to today. And a lot of people, like I had on the show page, the X-47 Bravo took off and landed from aircraft carriers. And a lot of people thought, okay, this is a pretty important milestone. This thing should quicken up. We should start to be experimenting more. We should get these things deployed here in the next few years. But here we find ourselves in 2022, and it's almost, I think, as Representative Banks has said, we've actually stepped backwards. Talk for a little bit about, was that excessive optimism for people who saw that in 2013, or as in it's a technical issue and an engineering issue, or are there human issues that are involved in seemingly treading water to going back since 2013?
You see, I'm probably not necessarily the best to answer that question. I just will say that, you know, some of the inspiration, going back to the first question about answering why we wrote the article, what brought us to write, was seeing the capabilities in JUCAS and the X-45 initially, and what it had to provide and offer, in the same in terms of the operating area that Trevor and I were in at the time when we decided to start writing, the challenges that we were met with on a daily basis in our mission planning cells to counter the threat that we were observing, and then reading about these capabilities that DARPA had produced and had actually fielded and demonstrated, and then that bridging that gap of, you know, producing that technology, demonstrating its capability, but then that the technology transition through that valley of death that is so often talked about in relation to DARPA's technologies that are fields, and then wondering why that capability is still lacking. Having been introduced to the MQ-25 program back in 2015 when I was at Nautic, and hearing some of the capabilities that it could have had in open source, and then seeing ultimately what is now being fielded, but again, not fielded for some time yet. So the capabilities that it could have or now will have are still lacking in our air wings going now towards, upwards of 2025, 2027, and continuing now, obviously, with the F-35, the capabilities it brings, but in terms of the unmanned aerial systems piece, not really incorporating that. And then the way that we field it now with warrant officers, aviation warrant officers in that program, and seeing how those will now be under the Aviation Command and Logistics wing, the representation that will have both in the command and control structure, but as well going forward, that advocacy in the Chief Naval Operations Directorates and going forward with folks that could assume admiral-level leadership to bring that capability again from now where it's at in terms of an aerial fleeing platform, further that to now where we need to be, placing it into those mission planning cell processes of how do we combat these anti-access aerial denial capabilities when manned aircraft, just the longevity that we have, whether it be a flying mission, overall continued number of sorties over multiple event factors or multiple days just isn't where we need. I think Colonel Spadaro could probably talk more to in terms of the human aspect there and the overall acquisitions capability quite a bit more, and then Trevor more so for the artificial intelligence piece of how we go forward with that.
Yeah, that's, you know, and I think something that highlighted – go ahead.
You got it, sir.
Yeah, I was just talking about – I wanted to dive into that culture piece a little bit because those – lead to very deliberate decisions. So, you know, what Kramer was talking about there is that the decision to, for the operators of the airplane was for the MQ-25, the decision is for warrant officers. And so without developing and investing in the people that will become the future leaders, in this case, there won't be future admirals that come from that community and really understand what remote aviation and edge compute looks like and the direction that we're going. Because and part of this cultural piece that I found really interesting, especially, you know, as a former commander myself, is the very thing that makes us so good at making a mission operational squadron, that combat effective capability that we can put forward, is the very culture in getting reps and sets and being very deliberate about mission planning and briefing, execution, and thorough debriefing, that very activity that develops our weapons and tactics instructors and populates our schoolhouses and allows us to meet our mission essential tasks, that very deliberate culture is the very thing that makes us kind of insulated and makes it difficult to break through when new capabilities are going to disrupt that mental model. It's really hard to make that paradigm shift. So that I found very fascinating as we're writing this article and digging deeper into the cultural issues.
And if I could kind of just jump in, one of the important things that we seem to be lacking in terms of integrating unmanned aerial systems into carrier aviation is the iteration part, which you alluded to earlier, Sal. Like, there's only so much you're going to learn in a laboratory, and there's only so much trust. And I think that's another key aspect of this trust. People don't trust the system because things like autonomy, artificial intelligence, those aspects are not in people's lexicon to include the U.S. military quite yet, or at least not as robust as we need to have it be. And so in order to build that trust, we have to have iteration. And just like you wouldn't expect a new guy or a new pilot to be proficient, we can't necessarily expect nascent technologies to be perfect out the door. So one of the things I would like to bring up is like JUCAS 2003 time frame, X-47 was canceled, I believe, sometime in 2015 or 2017. And now we're into 2022. So the first U.S. carrier, USS Langley, 1922, and then we have full-fledged carrier air wings and developed tactics by the start of World War II. And how did we get there? We got there through iteration. The fleet problems, Fleet Problem 9, that was the first time where we had maneuvers with fleet carriers and with a Panama Canal scenario. That's where they really kind of started to see, okay, what's naval aviation bring us? Where is it deficient? Specifically, it's planes at the time did not have the range, the payload, or the endurance that commanders would like. But that didn't necessarily stop it, but that led to this further iteration and more improved designs, which we eventually had by the start of World War II. And then at that point, the lessons that we learned during World War II further created better and better platforms. So by the war, we had a very dominant air wing that was highly effective. Now, how we got there is the carrier aviation in general was very much in the public spotlight. And I don't think that necessarily is the case right now with unmanned autonomy and, kind of tangentially to that, artificial intelligence. It's not so much in the public form, and that's kind of to our detriment because, back in 1919, the predecessor naval aviation was almost disbanded by the Navy. But the external factors to that was at the time you had Billy Mitchell, who was a very flamboyant and outgoing character of the U.S. The Air Service, which is part of the U.S. Army, which later became the U.S. Army Air Corps, and then eventually U.S. Air Force. He was a very outspoken proponent of aviation, to include the fact that he believed that all air power should fall under one service. And he also said that Coastal Defense, which was primarily a naval mission at the time, which should also fall under aircraft, and that navies were essentially obsolete. And so Billy Mitchell having the outside influence that he did with both Congress and the American public kind of forced the Navy to continue to pursue naval aviation.
Yeah, I'm glad one of you mentioned trust, because my older son just spent a few years as the requirements officer on OPNAV 98 air warfare, especially dealing with UAS's Group 3 and below. And a lot of what he was doing was driven by the demand of his customers. And as they grew more experienced using these smaller unmanned aircraft, their trust and their interest in having more competent machinery to work with became stronger and stronger. So the question is that, and he wrote a pretty good paper on this, and actually its paper topic is, when he was at the Naval War College, is about exactly that topic, about trust and the gap that's between when you have a technology that's new and being introduced and when it finally earns the trust and awareness of its limitations and capabilities that allows a wider adoption of its service. Now, if and I think that one of the points of your paper is that if the senior level people are intentionally, or maybe, you know, maybe not as intentional as we as the more paranoid among us would think, but are not trusting the these larger unmanned systems because they don't have experience with them, but then they don't let anybody get experience with them. This seems like a do loop to me, where it's never going to move on. And yet we have people like you three who have researched this, and Colonel, you actually worked with the systems. You know, how do we get your voices up the food chain to earn that trust and understanding at the higher levels? Are they just, you know, are their ears completely blocked, or is there someone up there going, you know, we really need to take a hard look at this, other than a few congressmen?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and jump on that to start. So trust is a fantastic topic, and I spent quite a bit of time looking at trust and autonomous systems at the Cyber War College last year, And trust is one of these things, and this is a quote, and I can't attribute it right off the top of my head. It was a book I was just reading recently, but it's gained in teaspoons but lost in buckets. And that quote, I just thought, really explains very well this challenge that we have right now, because as Mrs. was talking about earlier, you know, there's a lot of these capabilities, and especially when we talk about narrow AI, and particularly if it's self-trained, like the Alpha Dogfight, one of those agents was, and actually the one that won, the explainability of an action can be very, you know, disconcerting if it doesn't go the way that you expect it. And so this trust challenge is really important. But if you separate the things that have to be developed, you know, to very high engineering standards that we see in normal aviation and submarines and ships and these really complex systems, you know, typically it's 10 to the minus ninth is the level of certainty that you need that something is not going to catastrophically fall apart. That's different for things like flight control systems, where your outputs need to be very precise, they need to be known knowns, safety systems, as opposed to mission systems where you can have different algorithms or different components and sensors that can work together to give you varying probability of outputs. And there's a point where then you can compare human performance to a systems performance. And I think what we'll find is there's a lot of low-risk, high-payoff areas if we're able to dive down that thought path a little bit deeper and do deliberate experimentation. And carrier aviation is an important place to do that, where we find where can unmanned systems and edge computing, artificial intelligence, where can these capabilities best complement the human. You know, this isn't a competition. This is about survivability, lethality, force projection when needed. And so I think that's a really important thought about trust and how do you gain it in these teaspoons over time. Well, it's not just going to magically happen. It takes investments in education.
And if I
really
also
add
in there real quick, I don't know if anyone saw the article in the New Yorker recently on the 17th of January, but the rise of AI fighter pilots, artificial intelligence is being taught to fly warplanes. Can the technology be trusted? Fantastic article that wraps up, you know, all of DARPA's, you know, involvement in the field, Alpha Dogfight included, but then also trying to measure that inherent trust and the emotional response from humans and seeing how often when actually the technology would have produced a favorable outcome, humans intervening and because they just didn't feel like things were going right. But again, more of emotional response by the actual algorithmic approach that the technology was using, which would have achieved in their modeling in a more superior outcome. And I think it's a fantastic, you know, topic, especially, you know, the mitigation of human error and in terms of what we perceive the technology itself would result in. Whereas, you know, the mitigation of human error is a huge a component that in certain areas we could use with this technology if it was fielded. One thing I dealt with in the UK that was kind of eye-opening to me, again, as a junior officer, as a lieutenant, was, you know, after the UK had fielded its capability, the reality that the contingent capability requirements really hadn't been defined, and now we were trying to find a way to use the capability. It's something that we hoped in writing this piece would be an eye-opening aspect of, you know, who and how are we defining these contingent capability requirements from the assets that we are acquiring? Is it the manufacturer that is providing that asset that is delivering us a product and we say, yeah, that actually meets it? Is it a bunch of operators that sit around that necessarily may have a conflict of interest in fielding a capability that that could, you know, significantly affect their ultimate career path and their community and organization? Or is it directed from on high that we must find ways to add these capabilities to our arsenal so that we are able to continue to compete with other nation-state actors who are fielding and have those mandates in place to have an efficient and effective system to counter the threats that they also see?
Yeah, let me kind of pull the thread on that, because a theme that I could detect in the background in your article is the challenge that involves with, as you mentioned in the first part of your response, an emotional and other aspects of the human response to things that are new. You know, the incentives, disincentives, culture, even career path arguments. And the previous guest also mentioned experimentation and competition and trying to see how that works. And y'all did mention, and we also mentioned earlier in the show, you know, an example everybody likes to talk about is before the Second World War, the influence of the battleship admirals. And when you look at the time period from the First World War to the Second World War, really, you know, your basic career path from midshipman to captain or colonel, yes, the battleship admirals dominated. However, there were tremendous, especially in the last part of that from 1930 to 1941, huge advances in not just the technology, but the use and the concepts around, you know, two relatively novel items coming out of the First World War, submarines and naval aviation, to the point that by the time Pearl Harbor came around, we were 6 months away from having the best air wing of any naval service in the world. However, there seems to be something missing in our culture today that, in spite of all the power of the battleship admirals, they seem to be able to work around back there. And those things about, you know, incentives and disincentives, cultures and, you know, things as mediocre as career path, when you look at the human dynamic of the barriers that are between us being able to better advance in this area, what do you think is the most challenging barrier that needs to be attacked?
This is Spool. You know, to start off, I think exposure events is really important in understanding how the system works and how, because they're all very different. And what you see, and I've done many, many tours of different systems, provided those tours and things like the RT-21 Blackjack and different versions of the RT-7B Shadow and the MQ-5 Hunter and MQ-1C Gray Eagle and MQ-9. And what you'll find is, so each system is different, but without having spent a lot of time on those systems and employed them in combat, it's oftentimes hard because without the previous exposure, you apply your own mental model to what it is that you're seeing. And so if you're a tanker or an infantryman or a fighter pilot, you see the exact same hardware, you see the exact same experience differently. But unless you understand the underlying capabilities, what makes them possible, and are able to have that deeper level conversation, I think a lot of what you see in those kind of demonstrations gets lost. And so, you know, we're talking about this a couple of days ago as a group, and, you know, I'd like to just highlight the simple point of what's changed. And because change now today is very much software driven with almost all of these systems. And so radio communications and modern modem capabilities in the 90s really changed how we communicate with remotely operated vehicles. And things very quickly became digital, and payload capabilities increased. And miniaturization of the hardware, miniaturization of the compute power, has had a significant impact as well in the size of the payloads and the capabilities of these payloads. But so not that's the that's kind of a hardware compute opportunity, but all of these systems today are driven by software. So what happens as software becomes much more capable, and that software, you know, it's not a transistor, it's not some specific thing you have to go manufacture and then go through this, you know, extensive traditional development program that may take 10 or 15 years. Instead, it's a revision of code that delivers a new capability. So what happens when you can do that overnight and kind of like Tesla did with their cars, you know, deliver increased performance because battery management has changed, as an example? I don't think we're really prepared to think like that. And so we need to invest in our people in a very deliberate way in all of these different, you know, capability areas. So it's not just about communications and the ground control stations and what compute power means and how is machine learning develop an algorithm for one application, or what does a training data set look like, or what does commercial satellite processed through AI look like? It's all of these different things together. We have to be able to talk smartly across disciplines in this new advanced world that moves at the speed of software. And that's a very different thing that I don't think the force across the services. Air Force, I would say, is probably the furthest along in making this cultural change, just from observations, because I'm living on an Air Force base right now and have worked with some of these programs. But this is a generational change.
Yeah, I think, again, in my son's paper, he points out that to fully adopt unmanned systems requires trust that those systems will function as expected, and this trust is built upon understanding the systems. If someone understands the systems, they understand what's required for the system to work. And if you understand how the system works and its capabilities, then you know how to use them. And, you know, a lot of the younger generations who grew up playing video games and, you know, they're used to technology. Not that our admirals are all old fogies who don't use technology, but you know, there is a. I'm going to go back to the Air Force thing. Air Force Lab ran that experiment. I can't remember the name of it, but it ran the test an AI against an Air Force pilot in a simulation, and the AI won every single time. What, 13 fights or something. Anyway, but even then, the AI had its hands tied. It was using the same aircraft with the same capabilities and restrictions. The AI still won, but if it had been less restricted by unmanned systems being able to fly faster, turn harder, pull more Gs, there was no need to worry about the squishy human in the middle of it, as my son said, then the system that's unmanned, you know, especially as you just say, with constantly updated input and learning, it seems to me that this, if you understand that, it's really hard not to get the idea that this, maybe these systems would be really useful to us. Are there thoughts on that?
I mean, I think completely. And you know, there was actually an article that was released about actually wanting to fly. Having an Air Force pilot in an actual F-16 airborne to kind of dissuade some of the naysayers about the restrictions that were placed on that Alpha dogfight that was put on by DARPA and take out some of those artificialities. You know, a lot of things that restrict us are, you know, where we are beholden to training rules and we have a certain comfort level about how close or what aspect you're going to approach another aircraft with, and obviously the artificial intelligence driven in the simulator in the Alpha dogfight was willing to disregard all that, still operate within the safe margins that were directed by the event. But, you know, as claimed from the folks that participated in that, that comfort level was still not eroded from the human pilots in that overall event to actually achieve any measurement of success against the AI. But, you know, I think as Colonel Spatero talked about, finding places to build trust, mission areas to build trust. We're not talking about going to dogfighting immediately, but finding areas beyond just air over feeling to build that trust, to integrate those systems. You know, I'm not speaking necessarily from a position of absolute certainty here, but we just went through carrier air wing integrated training last year at in Fallon. And right now, as at that point, or at least that we had been briefed to, there was not any entity within the organization of the Naval Aviation Warfighting Development Center that was looking to integrate any type of unmanned aerial system or artificial intelligence into the carrier wings application. Now, that from our perspective as the customer of that training, it wasn't yet fielded, so we necessarily didn't need to train or practice to any of that or have any involvement or knowledge. But again, in terms of building that trust, having a cell stood up to find ways in which we can insert capabilities or identify capability gaps that we have where AI or UAS would be implemented, and then developing that in the overall concept of employment, concept of operations, and making, again, the aviator and the air wing feel comfortable that these capabilities are being implemented and how we're going to implement them. And as with any model, you know, what are the limitations and what are the assumptions? Because without that knowledge there, use of that model or use of that system is not going to be fully realized, nor will it be appropriately executed within the concept of employment. But finding those discrete mission areas where we can start to build that trust, I think, is the most important piece. And one of the main reasons that we wrote the article is, again, to get the discussion going, but also to find those areas in which we can start to build that trust amongst the community and get the discussion going.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the other things my son wrote about was the fact that with machine learning, the AI pilots could start out, if you want to call them pilots, right out of flight school with the knowledge of Chuck Yeager or John Boyd and only get better from there because the machines are connected directly. They have shareable intelligence. That seems to me that if you know, that needs to be a point that's got to be pushed. You know, it takes us a long time. One of my sons is an F-18 driver, so it takes us a long time to train pilots to a skill level that these machines, if they're properly programmed and set up, could start out with or even beyond.
And absolutely. And I think the other thing that we are, in terms of the operator level, at least very in an infant state about doing, is talking about risk. So with these systems, ideally, many of them would be down to the cost level of being attritable in an actual conflict. Where we can accept a greater risk of something not going right in terms of their overall capability, not necessarily in terms of executing a wrong decision, because we're not at the point where we're talking necessarily full autonomy of the actual decision to employ, decision to execute. But you know, the 80% solution may be sufficient in that type of actual conflict, where we often train to, in terms of the certainties that we need to achieve the mission objective with manned aviation, because we only have that one maybe fleeting opportunity. Or if the risk to force is so great that we attrite half of the force, our ability then to go and prosecute the next day or have any significant impact on the mission would be significantly degraded. Where if we're able to field a greater number of less costly assets, that if we lose a greater number of them but have a greater chance of achieving that mission objective, decisions would be significantly different. And again, I think that also goes into the trust that you're talking about from your son's article about introducing that into the force employment and having that be a more normal aspect of how we think about prosecuting the enemy.
I always thought that, I mean, and I'm going to steal this phrase in the future, the concept of being tolerance for attrition, attritable, is I'd always thought that as in all these things, you're not going to get the perfect system. You're not going to get the most advanced system to start off with. You're going to have basic and you're going to learn, you're going to build, and you're going to learn things you didn't know you were going to learn, and you're not going to learn things you thought you were going to learn. It will grow, but you got to start working with it. Was one of them was to approach this, and I've used in the past a couple of phrases just to get people attention, but the concept of a reusable TLAM, where we don't expect everything to come back, but you're going to get a certain percentage back, and you can reuse those, and that's okay because we've made it an affordable enough platform that it's not so expensive and exquisite that if you lose one, you are now at an operational risk of being able to accomplish your mission. And I've often said that it'd be great if we had the ability to have, for you science fiction fans, affordable unmanned aerial systems using this concept of a reusable TLAM that are stacked up in the hangar deck like a bunch of Cylon Raiders were from Battlestar Galactica. How much of a fight is there? Because it's clear y'all have had this discussion with people going towards a more basic, affordable platform that you have a higher level of attrition versus the people that want the one-stop shopping, exquisite Cadillac.
Start that off. I think again, coming back to the Air Force, but you know, working with DARPA and others, the Air Force Research Lab has spent quite a bit of time in this, and there's some developments that have changed what's possible. And so when you look at the Cirrus jet and you look at some of these smaller private jets that are available now based on like the Williams FJ motor, if you can take something like that that already has high reliability and certification built in, and then now you build a platform around that, then you get a totally different investment opportunity as opposed to many of the challenges that we've had with unmanned systems over the years. Without fail, almost you can look at these specific systems and in test and development, in early test and development and exploration of these capabilities, oftentimes there's serious catastrophic failures, and it's typically something that is preventable, but it hasn't gone through the same level of engineering as a manned aviation capability. So there's lots of opportunity then to explore that space and get into lower cost because you're capitalizing on what is already in production instead of trying to create a new production line that in just experimental and hoping that you know, it's scalable and that you're not going to discover things along the way that are going to really, you know, eat your lunch. The TERN program with DARPA is an example of that, and it didn't really make it very far because of that. Just one thing on the AI I want to hit on, then I'll turn over if anybody else have any comments on that, is something that really opened my eyes a few years ago was some work by some of the folks at the Navy Research Lab at NRL. And they published an article, a team of folks, and they were talking about goal reasoning agents. And so what I find interesting about this discussion is that the Alpha Dogfight started, and on purpose, because I think a lot of it's about building trust, about basic fighter maneuvers. So what do you do with a brand new lieutenant or ensign in a squadron? Well, you have to teach them basic fighter maneuvers before you can get into advanced tactics and weapons employment. And so that's what that goal was. That assumes that we'll have those kind of engagements in the first place, that we'll be able to close that gap and that we need to have those kind of engagements. Whereas this other study that I'm highlighting was a goal reasoning agent based on beyond visual range engagements. And a goal reasoning agent that was able to take in the different areas that would normally be scripted if you wanted to make a scripted agent, outperformed by 3,200%. And so when you put that in terms of kill ratios, that is mind-blowing. And we link that in the article as just a research point to demonstrate how disruption can really happen, but we're not prepared to have those kind of conversations yet. So back to that trust discussion, you know, it's really important that we dig deeper into these kind of, if you can have a tritable and if you can extend range, you know, it's not about extending a human's range with a tanker necessarily, although that might be value added in specific circumstances. But what else can we do that is, you know, putting the machine at risk further out in front? So I'll stop there.
Well, I'm glad you talked about it, because one of my notes was, you know, how many times are we going to have air-to-air combat in the old school way? And you know, I guess beginning with the F-14 and the missile system it had, it was beyond visual range. I mean, the TV camera, the thing could see further than human eyes. So, and you know, with radar and all that stuff. But I am constantly reminded of Dash. You talked about the drone anti-submarine helicopter that I put up on the web page, inviting people to join us. You know, that system died, and it died because it was paid for by NAVAIR, but it was owned by the Surface Force. In other words, it had no real owner, and it had problems. It was the old tube stuff. It wasn't solid state equipment. It still worked. They could use it for a variety of things, but instead of continuing to improve it, it got killed because, and the argument was that it was losing too many aircraft and all that. But a lot of those problems could have been improved and could have been kept. And instead of continuing that, we put manned helicopters on board ships doing basically the same mission plus some other ones. You know, this is the constant fight, I think, if you introduce new technology, is that it and I think you've discussed it, it's going to go wrong at first. There are going to be mistakes. There are going to be errors. You cannot walk away from a program because it's got that. And I gather that is, you know, we in the Navy, and I'm probably sure in the Air Force, you know, this zero defects mentality, it prevents sometimes experimentation that should be encouraged. Is that kind of what you see with your view going forward, or how these systems could be introduced and should be introduced? Bring some out, let them play with them, and we'll see where they break and see what the users say they could use them for.
I, for one, second that and believe, yes. I think there's a lot of opportunity in bringing industry into these too, going back to that basic premise that a lot of this is software driven. The Air Force, I saw an article just recently about Golden Horde and setting up a software factory for that. That's exactly the kind of ideas, because some of this can be done in modeling sim, and that's where these digital programs and digital twinning can earn trust and kind of work your way through that and think concepts in modeling and simming too. I mean, NVIDIA's got an amazing, that if you look at Omniverse as a digital twinning environment, that's an example of something in DoD that we probably should have and allow operators to interface and work through these kind of ideas, because the best ideas are probably not going to come from us old folk. But over to Mrs. or Kramer if you got anything on that.
Actually, I think Mrs. may have dropped the call there, but, you know, some actually probably would say that in terms of the traditional DoD acquisition strategy of, you know, evolutionary incremental acquisition, that the MQ-25 right now, as it will be fielded, is an air refueling platform, is, you know, a good introduction to gaining some of that trust. I think what we counter in the paper with, though, is this is a time when, based on the fielding of capabilities by the adversary and the operational environments we're placed in, maybe that incremental evolutionary approach to acquisition, we needed to do some type of a leapfrog and provide more capability than maybe some folks would be comfortable with, but that we know that would provide us that ability to counter those capabilities provided by the adversary. And in doing so, the trust would be gained. Necessarily, we wouldn't be relying on those platforms for the manned platform survivability, but it would be complementing our employment or extending our range of their own employment of weapon systems. But, you know, our worry is that we are not going at a pace that is quick enough to counter those capabilities based on the regions that we are being asked to operate in or the capabilities we're asked to hold at risk.
Well, and with that, Kramer, another part of this discussion, which required a fair amount of research, is really looking at where we putting our money and how long does it take to get to a certified platform, particularly when you start, integrating weapons. That is a very slow process, particularly when you go back to that 10 to the minus 9 discussion and working through initial operational test and evaluation and follow-on test and evaluation. And just do a quick Google search on those things and programs like MQ-8C Fire Scout or the RT-21 Blackjack or Triton MQ-8C. MQ-4C. You pick any of those programs, and you'll find that, particularly with unmanned systems, there's a lot of unknowns that start popping up over time as you go through these deliberate test events. And if MQ-25 follows that same path, it will be many, many years before we even talk about integrating advanced sensors and weapons for a platform like that, because we still have some major milestones to get through for that program.
Let's play alternative universe here as we get near the end of the show. When you read a lot of the people, including myself, who will write about some of the limitations they see on unmanned systems, people bring up issues of coding, software development, communication links, JAG, legal issues, our senior leader understanding of the technology and all of the above. And as people look at the challenge and the other side of the Pacific, I'm sure everybody here has heard about, the Davidson window of the threat of China. So let's say the good idea fairy gave me the capability to do a few things for you. One, I've got tens of billions of dollars I can tap into over the course of the next five fiscal years. And I have the ability to tap a few people on the shoulder and remove some bureaucratic hurdles for you. So you've got money. You've got enough top cover to go around some of your peacetime bureaucratic frustrations. Where would you invest effort and money to have something that would be of use to the fleet and projection power ashore that optimistically could be FOC by fiscal year 26-27?
All right, I'll start that one off. So back to the people, I think that's a really important start point. There are really smart people that have done their homework within the force, but their timing within the force, career timing or location just doesn't allow them to, we can't harness that that energy and that experience. So I would, if what you're saying, if that was the preconditions and we had an opportunity, that would be the first thing I would do is put together the right team. Part of that team is the operational experience, but part of that team is understanding how to navigate, I'll say, innovation within the bureaucracy, hacking the bureaucracy, because there are opportunities, but they're very difficult. It's very easy to run into no's as you work through there, no matter how much top cover you have, unless that top cover includes, congressional representation and specific leaders with the power to say yes within your service. And that's both on the service secretary side and on the military chief side. And so that's how I would approach it, is put together, that kind of Amazon style 1-2 pizza team that can complement all of those different aspects, and then deliberately get after experimentation, integrated experimentation, and find where we can complement, where's the lowest risk, highest payoff complement, or where's the most disruptive complement to our current operations? What would really force us to think differently if all of a sudden we had this new capability? I like to go back to one example of an urgent need statement for Space Marines that went back, I believe it was early 2000s. And, it sounded funny at the time, Could we be that far from something like that today? Probably a lot closer than we were 20 years ago. But over to Kramer.
I mean, I'm going to be extremely at the tactical level here, and something that I witnessed on a daily basis. But I'm sure most folks are familiar with LRASM, long-range anti-surface cruise missile capability that we've recently IOC'd in the Navy. But when you look at a manned platform having to tank multiple times to cover a credible range, I'll say, to release that weapon with its credible range, whereas you could have an unmanned aerial system that by itself, without refueling as many times as a manned platform would have to do, that could carry that same type of weapon system to the range at which it was needed to launch to have, again, a credible effect against the enemy, whether it be against a surface target in the maritime environment or in the land environment, if you're talking about its JASM cousin. In terms of a big bang hit right off the bat for a money investment of capabilities we already have, and you know, some improvements in all aspects of both the carriage and the missile itself. But the daily struggle of trying to find out how we are going to carry that missile to its launch range, that was on a daily basis the greatest struggle, and I think one of the easiest wins. Very basic, but something that is definitely achievable. And in terms of artificial intelligence, the amount of progression we have to make from where we are now is very low, if any, for that capability.
Well, that's a good place to stop for the day. I think we could probably go on for several more weeks talking about this stuff. But I want to thank you, gentlemen, for getting the conversation, the discussion going with your article. It's a really good piece, and I think that we need more input from the level that you guys are to get the concepts that, you know, these are important issues that need to be addressed right away. And I thank you for that, and I thank you for coming on our show today. It's been great talking to you.
Yes, thank you for the invite. This is great.
Sal, you won. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
And gentlemen, again, it was great talking to you. Real fast hour, a lot here, and you know, send me a note next time y'all write something. It was great to see some smart people putting some words out there. We need more of that. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Goddamn.